Today's podcast is brought to you by Audible.com. Get a free audiobook download at www.audibletrial.com/thedrilldown. Over 100,000 titles to choose from for your iPod and MP3 player. Hello and welcome to The Drill Down, the podcast where we take a look at some of the week's most important events in tech and on the web and how they affect us all. I'm Andy Sarcini.
I'm Dwayne DeFreitas.
And I'm Tosin Unifowaken.
This week, the NSA uses radio waves to spy on offline PCs. Credit card hacking comes to luxury retail. Google buys into home automation. And is net neutrality on the chopping block? As always, you can check out past episodes of The Drill Down as well as the other fine shows in the Geeks of Doom podcast network on geeksofdoom.com. Subscribe to us on iTunes by going to geeksofdoom.com, and our iTunes link is in the right-hand sidebar. And subscribe to us on Facebook and Twitter at The Drill Down. Our show is also on Stitcher at stitcher.com, and you can search for The Drill Down there. Before we get into the headlines, we occasionally like to do a segment on the show we call What We're Playing With, where we talk about the gadgets, apps, and tech that has obsessed us over the last week. And over the last week, I've been playing with a couple of new apps. And one is called Jelly. And Jelly is an app from Biz Stone, one of the founders of Twitter. And essentially, It's a question-asking app where you ask questions using pictures. And the other app that I've been using is called Questions, and it's essentially the same type of thing. You ask questions, but using short video clips, like 10-second video clips to ask a question. And then you submit that question to the community, and the community answers you. On Jelly, they can respond to you via pictures of their own, or just text, or they can draw on the picture that you have sent. On Questions, they respond using video as well. So you use your mobile phone to ask a question on Questions, and people use their mobile phones to answer the question, and you can have a threaded comment thread here. Now, with these two apps, which have similar sort of functionality, the one problem that I had with both of these apps is that they seem to they're sort of niche apps that do a limited version of things that other full-blown apps already do. Like with Jelly, I mean, the same kind of thing that you can do with Jelly, asking questions using pictures, you can already do with Instagram or with Twitter. Questions, you can already do this using a YouTube account. So my question to you guys is, what do you think about these specialized niche apps? Are they useful, or do you feel like they're redundant?
I don't know. Okay. So like, I definitely think that there's a space for them if people want to use them. We've seen time and again that technologies and services show up that are seem to mimic what other things can do, but because of their focus, they take off. Snapchat allows people to communicate highly effectively in a way that I am and everything could have done before, Facebook, et cetera. But it's focused on the moment, and because of that, people use it.
Yeah.
Over Kick and other things like that. Instagram itself, people kept on saying, just use Facebook. Why would you put your pictures on Instagram? Again, the focus on the images, the focus on the nostalgia, that's what makes Instagram so compelling. And then finally, to just finish examples, Twitter. People were like, I can just text. Why would I tweet it? Or I can just go on Facebook. Why would I tweet it? Twitter is, again, focused on super short things, a very limited way to communicate. But those restrictions cause a lot of creativity and a lot of communication. So I think there is room for these sorts of things. And I'm interested to see where they go.
Yeah, but do you think that there might just also end up being oversaturation?
No, because I think different types of people use different types of services. For me, a good app is the app that I open up when I'm in the elevator, the app that I open up in a waiting room. I want to see what's going on. For me, apps like that are like my reading app, Instructables, Instagram, etc. If you've got a question situation and you know you can go on there, and not only can you go on there and see what people have asked, you can participate in a relatively meaningful way. Imagine using Draw Something Like functionality on someone's photo to tell them, hey, this is the answer or whatever. That's something that you're not just like making a comment on someone's picture on Facebook or whatever. You're actually contributing to the world in some way, and that makes you feel good. Well, that makes most people feel good. So call it oversaturation, call it whatever you want, but it's a focused channel. And in a world of omnipresent social media, focused channels I have a lot of appeal.
Is there such a thing as too much focus in services like this?
Absolutely. You can get over focus. I mean, you can have something that's too narrowly focused, but when the focus here is the fact that people get to ask questions. Because of that, I mean, that's still pretty broad. I can ask questions about anything. Anything. social media is most powerful when it's based on an actual medium. Twitter is based on text. Instagram is based on images. Vine is based on video. This is also based on images. It's just that you're doing a different thing with the images.
Yeah.
And I think that's what's going to be appealing to people. So I'm not – I've looked at Jelly, and I haven't played too much with it, but I definitely think that it has the chance to be a winner, especially if BizStone takes the time to help people explore what it can do, get people to off to a running start. Then I think people will run with it. I mean, it's the same. That's the success he created with Twitter, right?
Right. Okay, Dwayne, how about yourself? What have you been playing with this week?
I've been playing with some stuff. So the first thing I've been playing with is I discovered PBS on my Apple TV. And as a cord cutter, I'm not a true cord cutter. I'm about to get cable because I'm moving and they gave me a good deal. But for a while, I've been a cord cutter.
That's how they get you.
Exactly. Well, the last time I had cable was the Olympics. So I'm getting cable again for the Olympics. I get it for the Olympics and then I cut it off. I want to watch the Olympics. So I started playing with PBS, but PBS is very interesting. Unlike the HBO app and all the other stuff, they don't actually ask you to put in like your cable provider, because PBS is public and it's available over the airwaves.
Sure.
They instead just ask you to like go to their website and tie in, and they ask you a couple of marketing questions, kind of, where are you, yada yada yada, and then it works. And from what I can tell, it's relatively unlimited for the last couple of years at least. So for a person like me who's interested in Nova and Frontline and Downton Abbey, it's all there. And you get new – I just didn't realize that you get new episodes of Sherlock, so I don't have to wait for them to all show up on Netflix.
Oh, yeah.
So for a person who does – like I do like to watch a show. I don't like to just flip through channels. It's one of the big reasons why I got rid of cable, because for me, flipping through channels is a waste of time that'll land you on something you never wanted to watch in the first place. But watching a show, I know I can dedicate, you know, 11 hours of my life to Game of Thrones. You know what I mean?
Right.
A season of Game of Thrones. So anyway, PBS is pretty tight. It's unfettered. You get access to a lot of great content. And, you know, it's just right there with your internet connection. The next thing I played with, though, is a bit more hardware-oriented, and that was the Tesla Model S.
Well, that is really hardware-oriented.
Yes.
Yeah, for those who don't know, Tesla is a manufacturer of electronically powered vehicles. They use an AC propulsion system to take a car that's about the size of – it sits somewhere between a BMW 5 Series and a 7 Series – it goes from 0 to 60 in about 4 seconds. I think 4.2 is the quoted term. And
isn't this the car that both Consumer Reports and Car and Driver rated?
Motor Trend.
Motor
Consumer
Trend.
Reports and Motor Trend rated this the best car of 2013.
Yeah.
The vehicle is made of aluminum. And if you've been listening to anything in the news this week, you know, Ford came out with an aluminum truck and people are excited about it. It's really tough. You can throw four of the frames of this car on another frame and nothing will bend because it's just well done. Anyway, 0-60 in 4 seconds, crazy roomy inside, a lot of amenities. I was in Seattle with my girlfriend and I convinced her to go for a test drive with me, which is cool because unlike Honda or Toyota, it's not a dealership focused company. The people who take you on the test drive are just purchasing consultants. They don't get kickbacks or commissions for buying it. So they just want to get the word out about the car. My enthusiasm sparked their enthusiasm. These guys are telling me things that they never get to that level, they said, with some other consumers that they've worked with. So while I'm not in the market for a car that begins at $57,000 and tops out at $120,000, I was able to spend, you know, 40 minutes. We were like 40 minutes apiece, got to drive it. And it was we were in like a $109,000 P85 model, which definitely makes you a little skittish on Seattle highways. But it's fast, and it feels like a normal car except for how fast it is. And you can turn like nothing else. There's no body roll. There's no anything. Mm-hmm. It's a fantastic vehicle. For me, if I were to pick up a car like this, I would need it to have a couple more practical things. Like, you know, it's got this great back seat where children can look out the back window.
Mm-hmm.
But there are no cup holders back there. If I have children, I need cup holders. Little things like that were keeping me from giving it like a straight 100%. But as a performance sedan,
yeah.
If you're going to be driving 300 miles or less in a place that's not too cold, and you have access to a charger on both ends, this car is a dream. I mean, the technology inside of it is fantastic. You have a 17-inch multi-touch display in the center. It's not an iPad, but it behaves very much like one. You can get Google Maps. The car has 3G as part of the purchasing price. And when you're driving, the actual 3D Waze type display shows up next to your speedometer in addition to whatever's going on the big screen in the middle. So you can see where you should be turning and everything as if you were looking at a cell phone or a traditional GPS device, because it's right there next to your speedometer. It's got crazy settings. When they released the car, because it's electric, if you let go of the brake, nothing would happen. Then people were like, well, I'm in traffic and I don't want to hit the acceleration pedal and then hit the brake again. So they introduced a setting called creep, which means if you take your foot off the brake, the car will inch forward as when you are in traffic. Things like that happen. You can have it on eco mode, which has crazy regenerative braking, which means you basically never use the brake. It's just a question of like how you tap the acceleration pedal.
Wow. Interesting.
Or you can be in sport mode, which sport mode, you're driving a go-kart. You're driving like a 4,000-pound go-kart, which is as dangerous as it sounds.
Wow.
But you can do anything in that vehicle at that point. So yeah, I mean, it's a fantastic piece of engineering built right here in America. I think they are way more a tech company than they are an automotive company. I was almost surprised that they didn't make a bid for someone like Nest, sort of like, we are your home, you know, your car, mm-hmm, your house, mm-hmm, these kinds of things. And yeah, the experience was great because the customer service was fantastic. Tesla is looking at two new vehicles. The Model S is, again, they're kind of like BMW 5 Series kind of vehicle. But they're going to take that platform and create a Model X, which is an SUV crossover on that platform. It's got these cool golden doors. It's going to be gorgeous. What I'm most excited about is what they call their Blue Star project, which is a $30,000 to $40,000 compact executive vehicle. So imagine a BMW 3 Series or an Audi A4.
Sure.
But on an electric drivetrain that, again, gets like crazy fast speed. That's the kind of car that I'd be interested in, because I already kind of have a crossover SUV, a big car, and I'd like something smaller and to zip around the city. And if I could zip around the city and just kind of drive home and plug it in, I mean, how great would that be? But that was if you live in a city with a Tesla dealership, ask for a test drive. They want you to come. It's not a burden. You don't pay anything. You don't do anything. Just don't bring your coffee in the car because it's expensive. But they will tell you everything about the car. They will, you know, and they will take any feedback you have to the company. I mean, they're just very excited about the product. It's doing very well among the affluent, I guess.
Sure.
They want input from geeksters. So go check it out.
That sounds amazing. I would love to get my hands on it, especially with such a large center screen.
For me, I was a little – at first I was turned off by it because you can't really – like, I like buttons in a car because my eyes are on the road. Road odometer.
You need something tactile.
Yeah, something tactile. But you can get to a lot of it on the steering wheel, and then you can do a lot of stuff on the – you can do a lot of, like, interesting stuff. They make it pretty intuitive. It's pretty intuitive. What's also funny is, again, they update the settings on things. So people kept on trying to clean the screen because it gets fingerprints on it over time. And they kept on hitting buttons and changing stuff. So they have an actual screen clean mode where it turns black and you have to like triple tap it to get it back to normal. They're constantly thinking of ways to get more out of the car. My car, it's, you know, it's got navigation and stuff, but if I want an upgrade, I basically have to buy a new car. If I want to update just the navigation information, I have to spend $200.
Right.
That's not what's up with Tesla. Now, is the car expensive? Crazy expensive. But these are the kinds of things you think about with technology. My iPhone gets updated. My, you know, if you bought a Nexus phone, you get KitKat. You know, these things happen because someone's trying to keep the ecosystem alive, and that's what's exciting about it.
Sure.
But can you play Angry Birds on it?
It's true. It doesn't have Netflix or Angry Birds, so I don't know if it's considered a connected device. They do have a pretty tight app for your phone, and they have the actual key fob for the car. Mm-hmm. It's shaped like a car. So when you double tap the front part, what would be the hood, the frunk opens up. So it has a front trunk.
Oh, wow.
When you double tap the back part, the trunk area opens up, and it does have like this crazy large super sunroof thing going on, which is basically like you can open up most of the roof of the car when you're driving, which is pretty fantastic, panoramic display kind of stuff. So yeah, it's a fantastic automobile. Elon Musk really knows what's going on.
And Tosin, how about yourself? What have you been playing with this week?
So today we just released a new app, a new iOS app for Box. So full disclaimer here, I do work for Box as an employee of that organization.
Disclosure, not disclaimer.
Yes, disclosure, yes. But we just released a new iOS app, and this is really, for me, this is really one of the best enterprise apps that I've ever come across. It's in terms of performance, it is incredibly fast. It's really fluid in terms of viewing all. I think it currently supports over 100 different file types,
mm-hmm.
and actually performing presentations. So one of the really slick things that you guys will notice is if you're, you know, paging through a PDF, typically with a lot of the apps that you page through documents, you slide from the bottom up and it goes from page to page or only shows you part of a page. The way mm-hmm. the slide is built here, you actually pick a corner of the page and you flip it over. Sort of like the typical iOS book page flip, uh-huh. except you have a lot more control. So if I start bending the page up, you know, 45 degree angles, it will bend that way. If I start moving it, if I start curling it, it's amazing. It's really slick there. Plus, it also gives you the ability to inline search all your content, right? So that PDF, if I'm looking for a particular phrase or sentence someone said, I can find that with a very fast and efficient search criteria. It's actually really amazing, the concepts that went into that whole design. And
that's pretty tight. I mean, that's inline searching of documents is really great. I actually dislike iOS a lot because I can't inline search a web page very easily. I kind of have to get confused before I could actually do it. Being able to do it in any kind of document, PDF, Word on my phone, that is a great piece of that's a great bit of functionality.
Yeah, and I think that just the high fidelity you get, especially with images and even with audio as well, it basically can function just like a player. Typically in the past, you would have, you know, say you have one audio file, or say you had a soundtrack within a folder, you'd have to play a song and then skip to the next track and then skip to the next track. Now it automatically plays, as well as if you hit the hit a button combination, you can see the entire list of audio files you have in that directory, one right after the other. Same thing with the image views. I think it's really marvelous what they were able to achieve, and I'm just super impressed with it and definitely recommend checking out. And if you have used Box before or haven't used Box before, there's currently a 50 gig promotion. So this is for both existing and new users. If you download that app, and if you already have that app, you have to log out and then log back in. But if you download that app, And you don't, you can get up to 50 gigs. So if you already have 50 gigs, you're not going to get anything else. But if you have less than that or none at all, they'll bump
curses.
You up to 50 gigs.
Curses. Give me 100 gigs. I'm loyal. I've been there since the beginning. I want more gigs.
More gigs. So definitely worth trying out. I'd love to hear your experiences after you guys install it later on.
Absolutely. Absolutely. I've installed it earlier and I'm going to be playing with it later on this week. All right, let's get into some of these headlines here. So last week we talked about CES, the 2014 CES, Consumer Electronics Show. One of the things we didn't cover was during last week's CES, Valve showed off the 13 official third-party vendor systems designated to be Steam machines. And there's a terrific gallery of them at Ars Technica. These 13 Steam machines feature an array of Intel cores and graphics coming from all the major players. And they have basically have them all on display, plus the specs. And they range anywhere from $499 at a starting price. And that's like $499 is the CyberPower PC, the iBuyPower. And you can go up to... Falcon Northwest's box starts at $1,799 and it can be fully loaded at $6,000.
Ooh, that's a pretty penny.
Yeah. But all in the name of high-powered gaming. Did you guys get a chance to take a look at this gallery? And if so, what did you think?
Yeah, I mean, there are a lot of really beautiful machines. But the first thing that I thought of was... This is a really brilliant move by Steam, not having to be in the manufacturing aspect of it. Mm-hmm. They don't have to make machines or think about losing money towards that aspect. And if anything fails with a particular machine, it doesn't completely negatively affect them. The first thing I would think
right.
is actually look.
There's a lot to that. I think it's smart to at least start off by not making your own hardware. But we've seen software companies moving toward hardware very quickly. Google buying Motorola, making the Nexus devices to begin with. Microsoft with the Surface. And I think there is something to be said about owning your own hardware. But it is an expensive thing to get into. And Google and Microsoft are very big companies, and Steam is not. For me, I was a little surprised that ironically surprised. I wasn't really surprised. But... I kind of look at the specs necessary to be a Steam machine, and I'm like, an Xbox could be a Steam machine, and I'm kind of waiting for that hack to happen, rather than having another box under my desk. You know what I mean? But I mean, they're all very pretty. Mm-hmm. The idea that I'd spend $6,000 on a gaming machine takes me back to 2003 when I would build my own, right? So
much cheaper than that.
Well, I'd spend $6,000 to get a $20,000 machine retail. but that's kind of like what that's the world was like back then, right? Like you cobble together multiple video cards and stuff way before, like, you know, $800 video cards and crap like that. But yeah, so I feel like I look at this and I'm like, it's good, but it's definitely hitting a demographic that may not be able to sustain the movement because it's not a very big demographic. So that's my concern. I do like the fact that Steam machines, there's a PC gaming aspect to it, and that's kind of a big deal. So I think this is definitely good work on their part, and I'm looking forward to seeing what the movement's like. I have a feeling the market for all these devices is going to consolidate itself pretty quickly. Within a year, I don't think there'll be as many Steam machines unless it becomes very easy to become a Steam machine.
Yeah, well, I would imagine that Valve will release I can't remember if they already have, but if they haven't, they'll release the specific specs so that people could, in theory, build their own Valve Steam Box, albeit not sanctioned by Valve itself. A box that can play the Steam, that can run the Steam OS. And play games off of Steam, the Steam service.
Think they will release that? Because it sounds like at least they'd be making some money if their partners are making money, right? So
I would imagine that it wouldn't be very difficult to reverse engineer what these specs are, unless there are specific unless there are specific chips where only Steam can run on these machines.
Yeah, I mean, like I said, I think it's...
There's a Hackintosh movement here, is the thing. Yeah, I think Tosin and Andy are both correct. Like, Steam is going to try to support its partners.
Sure.
Because its partners are where it's going to make whatever income it can. It's their platform and so on. But because these things are clearly personal computers that have been super hardcore rigged for this purpose... users are going to figure out what the necessary specifications are, and they're going to be in making their own Steam boxes. Now, will those Steam boxes suffer from the same things that Hackintoshes suffer from? Yeah, and by that I mean, it doesn't get the update, doesn't get the update on time,
right.
Someone's got to go and hack it. Yeah, maybe. And I think at least at first, Steam's probably committed to making sure that these devices are, sanctioned and used by their people.
Sure.
But over time, I think it'll open up.
Okay, let's move on here. So Canada's equivalent to the National Security Agency has admitted it may incidentally be tracking its own citizens. The admission posted on the Communications Security Establishment Canada's website came back on December 20th, though it went largely unnoticed at the time, which shouldn't come as too much of a surprise considering that many Canadians were unaware that the CSEC even existed until some of its programs were brought to light by former NSA contractor Edward Snowden's leaks. As member of the Five Eyes, the CSEC is one of the NSA's closest allies and its partners with the U.S. in various efforts like collecting phone records of citizens. In one section, the CSEC is surprisingly candid about the fact that Canadian law would seem to prohibit such activity. They said it's against the law for the CSEC to target Canadians anywhere or anyone in Canada. We also can't ask our allies to do anything on our behalf that is not legal for us to do. Apparently, Canadians have their own NSA, and the NSA is doing the same thing that our NSA is doing, albeit they're admitting it and apologizing for it. So,
like any true Canadian.
Exactly.
Yeah, I don't think any one of us is shocked that another organization, that another country is doing the same thing. I mean, I think it's kind of sadly to be expected. I just think a lot
of
them haven't been
taught. If America's doing
it,
Canada's doing it. It's as simple as that. If America is in there, Canada's right on the border, biggest land border in the world with another country. The NSA had to call up Canada and say, "Hey, you guys game?" And what could Canada say? But I guess we're game. I guess.
Right.
But yeah, Tosin, you're absolutely right. It's not surprising. The only people who are probably surprised here are Canadians.
Yes.
Oh my God, it could happen here, kind of thing.
Yeah. And in fact, they were.
Yeah. So, it sucks that this is the world we live in. But I think we all have to accept that this is the world we live in. In fact, what I feel like is the chorus of these organizations when they're found out is something akin to Scooby-Doo. And we would have gotten away with it, too, if it wasn't for that damn kid.
That damn kid, Edward Snowden.
Exactly.
Right.
It's clear that the way that the U.S. has chased down this stuff in the name of fighting terrorism is not in line with not just our principles, but a lot of the free world's principles. So that's something to think about.
In other NSA news, related news, according to the New York Times, the NSA has implanted software in nearly 100,000 computers around the world that allows the U.S. to conduct surveillance on those machines. But what's unique about this is that while most of the software is inserted by gaining access to computer networks, the NSA has increasingly made use of a secret technology that allows it to enter and alter data in computers, even if they're not connected to the internet, according to NSA documents. The technology, which the NSA has used since at least 2008, relies on a covert channel of radio waves that can be transmitted from tiny circuit boards and USB cards secretly inserted into the computers. In some cases, they're sent to a briefcase-sized relay station that intelligence agencies can set up miles away from the target. It's a fascinating article in the New York Times. Apparently, now, according to the article, there's no evidence that NSA has implanted the software used the radio frequency technology inside the U.S., but it's fascinating that it's a possibility. It doesn't even need to be connected to the internet.
This is one of those things that I was listening to a former NSA official talk about how much she hates Edward Snowden, and it's actually less because it's less about, you know, alerting the American people. He's like, if that's all he had done, then he could see a case for clemency. But the technologies used for surveillance, including these little tiny USB keys and things like that, they're technologies that other companies didn't even know they didn't know. They couldn't conceive of them. And now those technologies are out there. They're out there to be, you know, the idea of them being out there is there, which means, you know, the North Koreas of the world are going to go and chase down the capability. Yeah. They're going to go seek out capabilities that they had no question about. One of the reasons why the U.S. is not 5 years ahead of everyone else, but like 15 to 20 years ahead of everyone else when it comes to intelligence is because we have dedicated groups of people thinking about different ways to get into systems to find information. And we have other dedicated groups of people who are committed to thinking about what is the most edge case scenario and how could we prevent it? Which is why, you know, there are random things that are happening out there, like police cars, many police cars in multiple in Minnesota, for instance, they all have cameras that scan everyone's license plate as they drive by. And that data is put into a big database. So they can actually, without anyone having committed a crime or anything, they can track the patterns of your car because the data is sitting in the database. Now, unfortunately, that database is open for almost anybody in Minnesota to gain access to via the web because no one thought about the privacy aspect of it. But the fact is, these technologies exist. And, you know, while Snowden has done a very interesting thing by letting people know about them, he's also exposed a lot of the means.
Sure.
And it may be that might have gone too far. That might be a bridge too far. It might be beyond the pale vis-a-vis our, and I'm going to say our because we're all American, our ability to stay ahead of the game, so to speak. It's one thing to say, hey, citizens, you're being watched. It's another thing to say, hey, this is how you're being watched. Here's every single thing. And, you know, you may not be able to have one without the other. You might not be able to say, hey, you're being watched, and I'm going to prove to you how much you're being watched because I have this data. You know, that's a big piece right there. But it's definitely not helping him in the eyes of those who want to see clemency for him, the fact that he's exposed devices like the one that you just described.
Following last month's revelation that hackers had stolen the credit card records of 70 million of Target's customers, upscale retailer Neiman Marcus acknowledged last week that it's investigating a hacker break-in that's exposed an unknown number of consumer cards. Sources say that while it appears the fraud on those stolen cards was perpetrated at a variety of other stores as well, the common point of purchase amongst the compromised cards was Neiman Marcus.
That's an expensive store.
It is an expensive store. It's probably,
which means that they've got a lot of data regarding a lot of people who don't look at their credit card statements closely every month.
Right, right. A lot of people who probably did not notice that their cards were being compromised until a lot of money had changed hands.
Right. I mean, here's the thing about these kind of humongous things. What these hackers want to do is they want to pull off that 1980s penny bank scheme. They don't want to go and bankrupt everybody and take trillions of dollars out of your hands because they know that's not sustainable. The money can be traced.
Right.
They do want to, you know, make it look like it's some sort of insurance charge.
Sure.
Here's $6. Here's whatever. And when you do that for 10, 20, 40 million people, then suddenly your Swiss bank account has a lot of capital in it.
Yeah.
And if you're a gangster in the eastern part of Europe, then that's the kind of money you can use to conduct other nefarious business.
What did they used to call that? Slicing the salami?
I don't know. I know it's a plot line in many movies in the 80s and 90s.
Taking a little off the top.
Yeah, yeah. Just
skimming. If you skim the top.
Yeah, whatever, yeah. Just a penny here and there, a fraction of a penny, so nobody really notices. But you do that in enough volume, and you can get stinking rich.
And you win, yeah, exactly. Yeah. So, I mean, I feel like that's one of the things Neiman Marcus is an especially target for, that because people aren't going to notice a $5-6 charge. Let's call it. Let's not even call it once a month. Let's just call it once, right?
Yeah.
But even if they're doing that once a month, you know, it's the ultimate negative option continuity plan. And I'm talking like negative option continuity is like when you look at the proactive commercials, right? Sign up once and you'll get this for free. And then in 2 days, we'll charge you whatever. And until you cancel, we'll just charge you indefinitely. Yeah. Only you never signed up.
All right. Let's take a moment to talk about our sponsor, Audible.com, the world's leading provider of digital spoken word entertainment on the internet. For the listeners of the Drill Down podcast, Audible is offering a free audiobook download with a free 30-day trial to give you a chance to check out their service. And the book I'd like to recommend this week is 12 Years a Slave by Solomon Northup. This is a landmark 1853 autobiography of the kidnapping and 12 years of bondage of Solomon Northup, a free man of color. This account was an immediate bombshell in the national debate over slavery leading up to the Civil War, and significantly changed public opinion in favor of abolition. And, of course, it's the subject of a recent film adaptation. Have you guys ever read this book or seen the movie?
No, I have not, but it's on my list of things to do.
I've never finished the book. I started it.
Mm-hmm.
Not an easy read, obviously. But I got to say that I look at this book and I hear how you talk about how, you know, it changed political will. You know, it was a very, it was, I mean, I assume that was in the North, because the South still went to war. But I look at that and I wonder if today's issues, today's, like, I guess, social cancers can be tied to, we don't live in an age anymore where a single writing can necessarily change anything. Like, I guess, look at Edward Snowden and say, well, his ability to get these documents out there has, you know, changed public opinion regarding national security. I guess that's kind of an example. But in the face of other evidence, you know, like we look at, I'm a gun owner, but you look at the whole gun school shootings thing. Two of them happened in the last 2 weeks, and we haven't yet seen a comprehensive written story by anyone that can move that debate. You know, these poor children die a year ago, and that debate doesn't get that moved at all. Now, should it get moved? I don't know. I think that, you know, people should be able to own guns. I think that there should be rules around owning the guns too, whatever. But it's kind of interesting how back in the day, the technology of the time, you know, books, printing presses, everything, there wasn't a lot of media out there. So when media did come out and it was compelling, it was able to rise to the top. You know, today you can watch – you know, you can watch that movie, or you can watch The Hunger Games: Catching Fire. You can watch The Secret Life of Walter Mitty. You can watch the Desolation of Smog. And frankly, in a world where there's so much like escapist, fantastic fiction,
media saturation.
Are you gonna chase down the story about the dude who was a slave and suffered all that shit on a Friday night when you're trying to forget about working Trump in drama, right? So it's interesting to see how the technology is so like the expansion of media is such that it would be much harder for a story like this to gain the kind of traction that it did back then.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I agree. I think you need to one would need to paint on a broader canvas than just a book. It would have to be some. It would have to be a number of. I think it would have to be a multi-pronged attack. In order to gain enough traction for people to really to really notice and affect social change these days. I think a good example of that is like the Occupy Wall Street movement, or the some of the anonymous protests, something on that level.
Those guys are definitely hitting a certain audience, and people. I think the Occupy movement was a move, but yeah, this book, you know, powerful in its time.
Yeah,
and I haven't finished it, but powerful when you read it, you can see why it changed public opinion.
Absolutely,
people should definitely check it out if they have the time with their readers.
I think people were shocked that this could have happened to a free person.
It's also really well written, is a big part of it. you can tell a story, you can show a story.
Yeah.
The memoirs of Frederick Douglass or whatever, he's telling a story, and it's well written, but it's not as compelling as 12 Years a Slave as stories go. Sure. So that's something to think about too. It's a unique
first-person account,
nonfiction.
Hard to beat that. In any case, to download that free audiobook or any one of Audible's other 100,000-plus titles, all you need to do is go to audibletrial.com/thedrilldown. Again, that's audibletrial.com/thedrilldown for that free audiobook and the 30-day trial to give you a chance to check out their service. All right, we're going to take a little break here, listen to some music, and when we return, are we about to lose net neutrality? Take a listen to this and come on back.
Oh, pirates, yes, there I so lie to the merchant ships. Minutes after they took I from the bottomless pit, but my hand was made strong by the hand of the Almighty. We forward in this generation triumphantly. So won't you help to sing these songs of freedom? That's all I ever had. Redemption songs. Redemption song. Emancipate yourself from mental slavery. None but ourselves can free our minds. Have no fear for atomic energy, 'cause none of them can stop at the dime. How long shall they kill our prophets while we stand aside? Some say it's just a part of it. We've got to fulfill the book. So won't you help me sing these songs of freedom? That's all I ever had. Hey, redemption song.
If you're just joining us, you're listening to The Drill Down on Geeks of Doom, the roundtable podcast where we take a look at the best in tech and on the web and how it affects us. I'm here with Duane DeFreitas and Tosin Anafawakin. The Federal Communication Commission's net neutrality rules were partially struck down this week by the U.S. Court of Appeals, which said the commission did not properly justify its anti-discrimination and anti-blocking rules. Those rules forbid ISPs from blocking services or charging content providers for access to the network. Verizon challenged the entire order and got a big victory in the ruling this week. While it could still be appealed to the Supreme Court, the order would allow for pay-for-prioritization deals that could let Verizon or other ISPs charge companies like Netflix for a faster path to consumers. Now, perhaps it's time for a refresher course on what exactly is net neutrality. Because net neutrality is one of those things that I know what it is when I see it, when I hear about it, but I would be hard-pressed to give a set definition of it. So therefore, I'm going to pass it to you, Tosin, to take a crack at it.
Sure. So net neutrality really refers to kind of a set of rules or guidelines that the FCC established in 2010. And really, the guidelines were there to basically say that all aspects of the internet are equal. And in terms of the traffic, and there were a lot of other rules and ideas that were formed around this sort of guiding principle. Yeah. So, for example, take Netflix as a service here.
Sure.
For example, that would mean that any sort of content that Netflix was serving to you, they wouldn't have to be governed in terms of additional expenses by your ISP.
Right. One price for Netflix feeds all. Like they are able to get to keep their internet, the price of their internet access the same to serve to customers, so that customers can have as much of Netflix as they want.
And more than that, I mean, if you're a Netflix and you, I mean, the reason the case is brought is because Netflix is 30% of Time Warner or Verizon's internet traffic. So that's a lot of traffic. And the idea is that, okay, Netflix can afford to, in a world without net neutrality, suppose your cable company says, Netflix, you're a lot of traffic. I'm going to make you pay for that, pay for this at a different rate because you're just so damn, you're so, just so heavy with the traffic. And that is now the rate for streaming media services. And we come out with a drill down streaming media service and we have all the Geeks of Doom content on it. And we're like, yeah, and we put it out there. Suddenly the cable company's like, well, you guys are doing streaming. You're going to have to pay the same rate as Netflix. And I know you're a startup and you don't have any money, so I guess no one's ever going to see your content. And that's one of the big questions here. Question number two is, hey, Netflix, because we're charging you so much money, you better pay it. And Netflix is like, well, I can't afford to just pay this with what I'm charging people, so I'm going to have to pass that, some of that cost or all that cost onto everybody else.
Exactly.
So suddenly your Netflix bill is $89, at which time you're like, oh, so I'm going to go ahead and cancel Netflix and just pay for cable.
Right.
Is what I'm going to do. Right. And that's really kind of how this is coming together.
Yeah, and the really sad thing for me, and this may be my own bias, but it seems like the problem that we have in general with legislature is there seems like there's so many hands in the stew who are also the people who rule over how it tastes and how it should be presented. Like, yeah. It just – there always seems to be conflicts in terms of, like, who is making the ruling and who's in charge and their set of connections, and it just
– Give me an example of what you mean. I don't really get the stew thing.
So – and maybe that's a bad sort of reference, but what I mean is in this particular case, the new ruler what's his name?
The new head of the FCC.
The new head of the FCC had previously, before he was hired, had connections to, you know, the same sort of organizations that are impacted by these rules. And so I think the description that I was previously trying to discuss is kind of maybe not really like hands in the pot, but more like, you know, the same people trying to produce these laws also, you know, have greater – it affects them to a greater degree than just making a neutral ruling as a, you know, position in power.
Sure. It's Tom Wheeler.
So there's a lot of special interests going on is what you're saying.
That's what it feels like.
They have
it
a
always
lot of special interest
way.
In making sure that the rules go a certain way because they will probably benefit in some way or another.
Like I don't know. Does it feel that way to you guys as well?
I don't know about the FCC head, but I do like to trust the judiciary, and this was a United States court ruling. From here, the FCC can appeal, or it can try to go to Congress and say, Congress, change the law so that I can do this. A big piece of this was, you know, like telephones are a utility. They are not an information service. They are a very necessary piece of what we do. And a long time ago, the FCC did not consider the internet to be the same way. And that's a big problem. That's one of the big problems we have here. So the internet is viewed as an information service.
Yeah.
And thus, there is no kind of equal protection situation when it comes to everything going off over this information service. You know, different things can be charged. Different companies can be charged different prices and so on according to the way the rules have been set up. Now, the FCC's tried to move it back into the telephone domain, but without a congressional, you know, without a bill, the court doesn't really recognize it because, like, you originally said this, and now you're changing your tune to do this net neutrality thing, which I don't really see the logic behind. And that's the issue here.
There's a great article on BuzzFeed, Welcome to the Net Neutrality Nightmare Scenario. And I felt that the guy on BuzzFeed summed it up well. He's referring to an AT&T scheme called Sponsored Data, in which AT&T is planning on letting content providers paying for users' data, sponsored data. And that would be possible under this new relaxed net neutrality scenario. And the way they summed it up is saying that sponsored data proposes the possibility that video sites, music sites, and social networking sites could pay for users' access. The appeal to such an arrangement to a regular customer is obvious. You'd pay less for your data, at least directly. Customers don't like it when you take things away, so carriers need to be more subtle than that. They'll do so primarily by creating artificial scarcity, data caps, requiring customers, or now internet companies, to buy their way around them. The appeal of this arrangement to the internet's largest companies is even more obvious. It would give them unprecedented control over the internet and its users. If, in the future, you're choosing between two streaming music services and one of them pays for your data, there's a very good chance you're going to pick that one. But which one would be able to do that? The largest one, the incumbent. This will have profound implications for the internet's ecology. Companies that were willing to fight for net neutrality in the old days won't be such strong allies in 2004 now that they are the largest incumbents on the internet. They're big and they can negotiate. Once you're on the inside, exclusion doesn't seem like such a bad thing. If you're Google, maybe getting access for YouTube is what you want, rather than what you want to fight. So this change in net neutrality rules it could really negatively affect the ecology of the internet. And it may be something that the most devious thing I find about this is it's going to be something that seems beneficial to us at first because it could involve companies paying for our data.
Once a company starts paying for your data, suddenly you're beholden to them in whole new ways. The terms of service and privacy will change because right. they need to monetize that situation. Frankly, the idea of getting rid of net neutrality to me is like turning the information superhighway into a toll road. Everybody needs, in order to fly on it, you're a small blog or whatever, your site's loading so slowly because Engadget and The Verge, you know, they're paying the money to have their content load faster. And that's really what it comes down to. And you're right. It's all about this idea of these bigger companies that have negotiating power turning the internet into a pretty oligarchical place. A few companies have access to – they hold the keys. They can afford the tolls. Yep. So they're the ones who get out there. Right now, wireless internet communications can be data capped. That's one of the reasons why it's just that's how it works. Verizon, because wireless is so expensive to produce, Verizon and the others can think about figuring out ways to cap wireless stuff. When it comes to the wired stuff, though, this is where the net neutrality, you know, really begins to become a pain point. So this is one to watch, I think.
Yep.
Is the FCC chairman looking at multiple ways to get around this ruling, turn things back before Verizon starts coming out with marketing plans. What's interesting to me is that this wasn't a class action.
This wasn't Verizon, AT&T, T-Mobile, and Sprint all getting together and saying, this is so wrong. We want to be able to control our pipes. No, this was Verizon pretty much on its own doing this work.
Yeah.
And that to me is very interesting.
And they've been fighting this particular fight for years. They were the ones who initiated this particular fight. So there you go. Okay, so moving on to our last headline of the night. Google has acquired Nest Labs, the company founded by Apple iPod creator Tony Fadell, for $3.2 billion.
That's a lot of money.
That is a lot of money.
But it's an awesome product.
Yes, anyone who's used Nest Nest, except for me. We've discussed this before the show, but regardless, my experience with it aside, they love it. They make the innovative digital thermostat called the Nest, as well as smoke detector called Protect. Nest has been close to completing a funding round of upward of $150 million that would have valued it at more than $2 billion, but that round never closed because Google swept in with this offer. Sources familiar with details of the acquisition said Google was the only serious bidder and Apple was not even in the mix. Google said the acquisition, which is subject to regulatory approval, was all cash and that the company would continue to operate under its own brand. Essentially, you do what you want to, Nest.
For now. I mean, let's get into the brass tacks. Google owning this company means that a lot of bets are off. Nest 4.0 may not even support iOS. Now, I don't think that's going to be the case because there's a lot of money in iOS. Google makes a lot of money in iOS. But what it does show is that while your devices may be Apple, more and more your services are Google. Gmail is big. Google Calendar. Google Drive. You know, it's no one is I'm not going to say no one, but, you know, Office is taking a hit because of the Google Drive product. So your services are Google. You can get to them from any device, including your iPhone. And this is an interesting move for Google because anyone who's in advertising understands that advertising today is all about following someone online. What's their online behavior? What kind of ad can you show them based on the way they've behaved in the past? Problem is, if you're a retailer and you're not just a straight up ad agency, yeah, you want to know what the in-store habits are, the real world habits are,
sure,
of your consumers in addition to their online habits. Yeah. By using devices like the Nest and the Nest Protect, the Nest Thermostat and the Nest Protect, you know, Google can eventually begin to understand when consumers are out of the home, what times are they in the home, and begin to create significant profiles. Even if they're aggregated profiles,
yep,
and not just, yep, chasing an individual down, they can create significant profiles that allow them to get this kind of information to their customers, the advertiser. A little big brother, a little scary. And frankly, right now, Google has said, hey, privacy policy is still intact. Don't worry your pretty little heads about it. This is going to be fine. But the fact is, just like Instagram now is Instagram Direct, over time, Nest is a brand that will merge and become more and more part of the Google world. Now, we know Google likes to keep separate brands. YouTube is not Google Video. YouTube remains YouTube. And Nest is a really powerful brand.
Yeah.
But it's definitely something to think about, the fact that because it's no longer independent, so to speak, because it's under the, you know, the thumb of Google, it is a company that has a lot of data,
yeah,
that can be not monetized. Like, I was talking to Andy earlier this week, and we were basically saying, you know, they call it the Nest Protect, but eventually it could be like the Nest Connect, because everything you're doing is connected online.
Right. Well, this will allow them to branch out into other appliances as well.
Well, that's the thing. So Nest, unlike we talked about Tumblr, we talked about Instagram and these billion-dollar purchases for companies that, you know, Instagram is pictures, Tumblr is like little GeoCities websites. Nest makes a product, yeah, a product that people love, a gorgeous product that has manufacturing costs and other things about it. So this price tag is pretty impressive, because it does play into the fact that Nest is a product. Yeah, I do think that. Go ahead.
No, I was just gonna say, and this is, I think, a quite a great move for Google getting into that, you know, data of the home and
absolutely
the sort of internet of all things, by taking such a major player and dominant factor in that industry, and being able to eventually, you know, incorporate it into their other elements. I mean, imagine doing a lot of this control from your Android device and being able to go into your Google Plus profile and monitoring some of the temperatures at home. And yeah, you can see all the various areas where this would be a pretty slick integration.
Yeah, and the big thing here is CES was full of connected stuff. LG and Samsung each have their own Roomba-type vacuum cleaners that you can control via Wi-Fi. Refrigerators are talking, yada, yada, yada.
a lot of those applications of connected technology are not compelling, right? Like, I have a Roomba, it's on a schedule. I would love if I could connect to it on my phone, but it's really not necessary. Neither is my refrigerator being connected. It's not really necessary right now. I guess it'd be cool if my stove could be a fridge and I could tell it to take the cold stuff in it and cook it, but it's not a direct understandable use case, especially for the price that they're asking for these things. But a thermostat, a device that controls your heating, yeah, that you can tell to warm up so that when you get home, your life is good. That is something that is pretty compelling. People get that. The idea that your CO2 smoke detector is one that you can just talk to. You don't have to get a towel, sure, and wave to it when you burn the toast. That's also pretty compelling. So these are really compelling things that are doing – it's like the connected home done right, done with class, so yeah, to speak. Not that the other, yeah, companies don't have class, but the fact is they're trying to make something happen here where it doesn't necessarily want to happen here. So I feel like Google, Nest, they Nest will get the resources they need to, yeah, move forward, different appliances. As long as they're all networked, it's going to be a good platform for people to want to be into. I'm sure it's going to do some wonderful things with Android eventually. So this is a pretty – I think we can expect to see a lot of really fantastic things come out of this relationship.
Yeah, and make no mistake, this is all about the data. This is about Google getting the data from these devices and using it to optimize how it offers products to people who have these devices.
I think that Nest was actually probably valued at 2. Whatever billion before anyone ever thought about data.
Yeah.
And I think that Google is looking at it from a data perspective, yep, the organization of the world stuff. And that really puts it in a strong situation. And Nest, I mean, if some of the rumors I'm hearing about what these guys are getting paid in terms of like the buyout, how could you say no? They can all retire tomorrow.
Also, I just want to point out the trend that Google has taken in the last few years with some of their blue sky projects. Some of their acquisitions, you know, it started with something like Google Glass, the self-driving car, these sort of blue sky projects that may have a limited.
I believe their term is moonshot.
Moonshots, yes, moonshots. But the moonshots that, like Google Glass, have a limited appeal. Like, not everyone's going to buy Google Glass because it's a very specialized product. But something, right, like Nest, you move on to something like Nest. The self-driving car is a moonshot that has a long range appeal in the long term when legislation starts changing to.
It's already changed. Yes. I mean, between you and me, you know that I don't even put that glass thing next to the electric car.
Sure.
Next. The glass thing is not happening. The glass thing it's not even moonshot. It's just kind of like, it's like a hobby. It's like what Apple used to call the Apple TV. Maybe it'll show up one day, but it's not here. The self-driving car, that's a connected device that makes a lot of sense.
Yeah.
No one wants to drive. Traffic can be saved. You know, everyone can get to where they need to go faster and do more stuff when they're there with their own little personal buses. And frankly, the whole car thing will probably eventually lead to something pretty interesting, like a car share program where you call up a taxi on your phone, a car drives up to you, and it's not even your car because you don't need a car because the computer drives it.
Now,
Nest is right in there with that.
Right. So now, I think add to that, Nest, their recent purchase of Motorola Mobility, the purchase of the 8 robotics companies that they just acquired. I mean, we're talking about this shift, this rapid shift from Google being a search engine, where their core competency was a search engine, to getting into the physical connectedness with the end user.
Also, them moving into becoming a straight-up devices company.
Yeah, yeah.
Apple was the devices company. Google was the online services company. it's in competition from Yahoo and MSN. Now Google has, you know, two dedicated device companies. The robotics companies aside, because that's definitely not necessarily super consumer aware. Consumers aren't aware of those companies necessarily. But, I mean, like when it comes to this Nest thing, home appliance, when it comes to the idea that your Motorola phone is a Google phone,
that's pretty
huge. Now imagine also a world where Google gets a company like Roomba, and suddenly your little smoke detectors are helping your robotic vacuum navigate your house better.
Yeah.
And you don't even have to think about it. So this is like a lot of, and that's what the Nest guy was saying. You don't want to have to think about a lot of stuff, so you can focus on the stuff you want to think about. And if Google can pull that off, you know, Google will gain the type of legacy and gravitas that I think most people associate with Apple.
Yep, I agree.
And Apple should be a little worried because Google, again, they're in the home, like deep in the home of, frankly, what are very affluent people. So that's something they should be thinking about. Nest people are not, they're not people who want to get the cheap off the shelf thing. They're spending $250 on a thermostat. So these are the people that Apple's been able to claim own the iPad, and thus, you know, while they don't sell the most amount of iOS devices, the most amount of mobile devices, they get a lot of money out of the mobile devices. I mean, Nest is approaching, is hanging out in that demographic squarely.
All right. We're going to take one last break. And when we come back, our drill down video of the week asks, will you marry me? Take a listen to this and come on back.
Fly me to the moon. Let me play among the stars. And let me see what spring is like on Jupiter and Mars. In other words, hold my hand. In other words, baby, kiss me. Fill my heart with song and let me sing forevermore. You are all I long for, all I worship and adore. In other words, please be true. In other words, I love you.
If you're just joining us, you're listening to The Drill Down on Geeks of Doom. I'm Andy Cercini. I'm here with Dwayne DeFreitas and Tosin Anafuakin. And it's time for our Drill Down video of the week. So before the show, I was torn between a couple of different videos. And one was very sort of tech-focused. But then I saw this video, and there was something about it that moved me. It really touched me at the heart. It's a marriage proposal. First of all, let me say right off the bat, and this took place at the Hydro Arena in Glasgow, Scotland, and this was during a performance of Peter Pan, a Peter Pan musical, and the...
Now, is this a public, will you marry me? Was this woman forced to answer the question in front of people who were looking and knew what was going on?
Yes.
That is a negatory.
No, you don't agree with that.
No, I think that's totally the wrong thing to do. This is a very private part of your life. You're about to make a family with another person. It's not something for public consumption.
Okay, but
that's why I am less into.
I hear what you're saying, but keep in mind that the two subjects of this proposal, the man and the woman, were the leads in this Peter Pan musical.
Which is exactly why, especially when you're working, let me stop you, honey, in front of all these people from doing your job to ask you to marry me.
He stopped.
No one can say no.
Well, you know, first of all, the secret...
Love allows for people to say no.
The secret of public marriage proposals is... You, you never attempt one unless you know for a fact that you are in that stage of the relationship where your beloved is going to say yes. There shouldn't be a doubt in your mind. Otherwise, if there is a doubt, then yeah, forget it. Don't do a public marriage proposal by any means. Obviously, this guy was certain, 100% certain that she was going to say yes.
But that doesn't matter. I mean, the thing is, as a person in love, you need to give this other person every opportunity to contemplate things. It may only take a second, half a second. Think about how many times you thought of a million things in half a second. But when you do it in front of all those people, there's too much social pressure there. And I mean, frankly, that's how it used to be. The reason why marriages lasted longer before is because society was all up in your business the whole time.
This is true. But you know what?
It's a fundamental. We can agree to disagree on this one.
Having said that, though, you have to admit, watching this video, if you're not touched, if your heart isn't pulled a little by this, then you're cold and dead inside.
I am not cold and dead inside, and I was not moved. I shall not be moved.
Because this woman's reaction was just priceless.
Because she had to...
No. It was not. It was definitely not. It was a surprise. It was not under pressure. She said yes practically before he finished the sentence. So
she wanted him to get up and keep on doing the show. No.
Well, anyway, I highly suggest you guys check it out. It's great. It's the first best marriage proposal of the year.
The first big public marriage proposal of the year.
Yes, the ultimate fairy tale ending. Peter Pan proposing to Wendy on stage.
Is it even really a fairy tale?
It is. It is a fairy tale.
I don't think it qualifies as fairy tale. I think that's a bona fide novel. I'm just going to break this thing up as much as I can.
You're just a curmudgeon. You're being misanthropic right now.
I am contrarian.
Well, you know what?
It's a great video and it's very entertaining. You know,
I'm betting on true love, and I hope that this this couple, their relationship lasts a long time.
How about forever? Because you're betting on true love.
Yes, forever. Okay, so that's it for this episode of the Drill Down. Let me go around the table here, and I'll start with you, Dwayne. Where can we find your work online when you're not here on the Drill Down?
You can always find me on Twitter, twitter.com/DwayneD, that's DwayneD. And you can always check me out at flavors.me/DwayneD, where a big aggregated piece of my online presence exists.
And Tosin, how about yourself? Where can we find your work online?
You can find me at twitter.com/toast4321, other ramblings at ircwebcast.blogspot.com, and I've started a new blog at toastr2d2.tumblr.com, which will progress my thoughts and visions around my R2D2 build.
That is exciting. I am very excited to hear about that.
It's by request. I definitely said, Tosin, I need you to blog this stuff so I can copy you.
Yeah, I actually mentioned you in my first post there because I was not planning to start this until after I actually really started the build. But there's a lot of good stuff that I'll be adding in the next few days.
This is great because it's a firsthand account of someone wanting to build an R2-D2 robot. That doesn't happen very often, even in our, you know, geek-connected society.
I mean, if that happened very often, we'd have to worry about the world.
At least I'm not building a Dalek.
Exactly. Yeah.
Oh, there you go.
Because that's what I plan to build.
As for myself, you can find me at MrBabyMan.com and Facebook and Twitter, both at MrBabyMan. If you got an idea for a story you think we should be talking about on the Drill Down, tweet us or email us at comments@thedrilldown.com. If you got a viewpoint on any of the stories we've talked about or any issue that pertains to technology, social media, or geek culture, send that story to submissions@thedrilldown.com for us to publish on the site. You can always let the Drill Down podcast help you reach the targeted tech-savvy market of influencers and outliers that is our wonderful audience by writing to us at sales@thedrilldown.com for details. And be sure to catch us next week at the same time and location. And that's it for this episode of The Drill Down. Thanks for joining us.